God, we are thankful to you again for the beauties of the week that you've given to us. And though those who study weather patterns told us there were going to be thunderstorms, we have not had those. And so we are grateful that you've provided such beautiful weather for us. And we are grateful for the bounty of spiritual food that you've given to us. We pray that you would increase our spiritual appetites by your word, by your spirit, that we might receive these things and take them to heart and to enlarge upon them as we meditate and think. And we do pray that you would protect us. We ask that you would guard us both in body and in soul. And we pray that you will anoint those who come to speak to us today, that you would bless them, and may they be blessed also as they see the fruit of their labors in a rising generation that will serve the Lord Jesus. You are our God by covenant, that you have bought us, and we pray, Lord, that we would honor you, therefore, in soul and spirit. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. We have been pleased to have Dr. Gary North with us during the week. This will be his last lecture with us, and so will you once again welcome Dr. Gary North.
This will be the fifth lecture on the topic of college. In the first, I attempted to show the distinction between the modern humanist concept of sovereignty, that is, who's in charge here, and the Christian concept. In the second, I discussed authority, meaning hierarchical authority, the question then of to whom do I report, and talked about the authority structure within the modern university. In the third, I talked about the ethics of the system, the content of the particular Darwinian forms of knowledge that are taught to you in the various classes, whether it be a class in biology, paleontology, or the social sciences. The Darwinism is dominant in all the fields, and the content of Darwinism is radically different from that which we find in the scriptures. In the fourth presentation on the winners and the losers of the system, I made it as clear as I could that I thought that in most cases the students are the main losers in the system, but they're not the only ones. And that I thought that it was possible to beat the system by using the system and to come out with just as good an education in most cases as you would if you paid full retail price. In this presentation, I'm going to be talking about what you do with that degree and the knowledge which you get in attaining that degree on the assumption that you do get the degree. Some people will not, perhaps because they don't go or because they drop out. But I will be assuming that there is a payoff, and that that payoff is in the form of a degree that has prepared you in some way for the remainder of your life. To illustrate what I think you need to know, I'm going to do what older folks do. I'm going to tell stories out of the ancient distant past. We refer to that in the field as having entered one's anecdotage. And the anecdotage stage is very important as you trail off, because you can't remember anything much anyway, but you can remember the old stories. So I shall tell you the first story in which my life was radically changed. It happened twice in my life, and this was the first time. Almost exactly 53 years ago today, I spent 24 hours preparing for a trip, and I spent it in a very effective way. I took a girl to an all-night party. She was a senior, I was a junior, and most juniors did not go to the all-night senior party, but I had heard that the young lady had not been asked. She was a nice lady. And I put the word out that if nobody asked her, then I would be willing to take her to the all-night senior party. which she took me up on the offer. Which leads me to North's prime operating principle, which is a consolation prize is better than no prize at all. And so, having taken her to the party, I then prepared myself for an all-day ride on a train. In fact, all day and all night. That train left at Union Station in downtown Los Angeles. And it would take me and about 400 other boys to the American Legion Boys State Program, which was being held across the country in virtually every state capital, and I was in the state of California. And so up I got, never having gotten to bed, and what I didn't know, I wouldn't get it to bed again for another 36 hours. And that was the longest of my life I was ever awake straight, and I don't recommend it on anybody. So I got on the train, and we began to meet each other and size each other up and decide who's going to run for what office when we got up there. And sometime in the afternoon, I do remember that the light was still up, so sometime probably after noon but before evening, I was sitting in a chair on this rattle trap of a train, and somebody said, Lenny Ross is in the dinner car. They didn't actually service anything, but there was a dinner car. And I said, you're sure? And he said, yeah. I said, let's go. So we walked to the back of the train, or to at least the central section of the train where the dinner car was, hoping that we could get in, and we could. There were a couple of seats left. Lenny Ross was a legend. The year before, he had gone on a national quiz show. I think it was the $64,000 question, which was the first of the big ones. It may have been an imitator or a spinoff, but I remember the top prize was $64,000, and Lenny Ross went to the top and won it. Now, $64,000 may not sound to you like a lot of money, but in those days, you could buy a three-bedroom, two-bath house in Southern California for about $17,000. And he did so well in that he was invited to participate in another quiz show, and he went on that show, and he won $100,000 on that quiz show. And his field was the stock market. So he was on the train. I said, I want to see this. So we went to the back, and I sat fairly close, probably two seats behind him and on the right-hand side. I remember it extremely clearly. He was sitting surrounded by very bright guys. And one of them had a piece of paper in front of him, and he was writing down chemical formulas. And he would call out the formula, and Ross would compute the formula in his head before the guy could write down the answer to the formula on the paper. And there were two or three guys doing this to him. Now, this isn't chemistry. This was not his main field. Lenny Ross was 12 years old. At 13, he graduated from high school and went to Reed College, which was the most liberal college in the West Coast and probably was, and even now probably is, the most liberal college in the United States. He graduated in 4 years and went to Yale Law School, entering at the age of 18. Not until about 2 years ago, because of the web, was I able to get the following story. It was in a New York Times article by Maureen Dowd. And she had traced back to his history and had interviewed people who knew him. And she interviewed one of the young men who was at Yale Law School. And he said, well, we had heard about this kid who had come from the West Coast and that he was really very bright. But he said, we were all very bright. So on the first day of class, the professor asked a question, And Lenny's hand went up, and Lenny gave an answer. And he said, at the end of the answer, a chill went down my spine. Lenny had read every book and every assignment for the entire first year when he walked into that class. He graduated 3 years later and was made professor of law at Columbia University at the age of 21. He got bored with that, later came to the West Coast, began working in California politics, wrote a best-selling book with the perfect title called The Best, and continued his career. Went on then to Bolt Hall, which is probably the best law school in California. But he began to have problems. He had problems memorizing things. He had problems retraining things. And finally, one day, one of his students was walking across the parking lot, and Lenny was under his car, face up, lecturing. He dropped out. He more or less disappeared. And I remember very clearly, in the mid-80s, my wife came in, I was sitting in the living room, and she said, Lenny Ross is dead. And I read the story, and Lenny Ross had committed suicide in an extremely bizarre way. He had climbed over a fence at a motel and drowned himself in the swimming pool. And they said he'd been suffering from depression, his memory had gone, his mind had gone. And he had lost everything. The fastest start of my generation, nationally. There was no one else close to him. I don't know that there's been anybody in terms of money earned and achievements earned since then to rival him, and he did not make it to age 40. And that, in long, long way back, was a kind of beginning, because it reminded me that the story of the tortoise and the hare that we grow up with is really true in some cases, and certainly in his case it was true. Fastest starter we ever saw. Poor finish. And the second story took place about 7 months later. When I went to Boys State, it changed me. I began to speak competitively for the first time, had a knack for it, continued to develop the skill. Probably could speak as well then as I speak today, if you want the truth about it, but I just didn't have as many stories. I ran for student body president. I very clearly remember waiting for the results. I went to a particular room in which we voted. And standing in that room, I remembered almost exactly 1 year to the day before, I'd been standing at the same room, and I had been running for the presidency of the Scholarship Association. And in my mind, that event 1 year earlier, also just having voted in what was an important election for me, seemed to be almost like yesterday. My mind went click. And the click was, the clock is ticking. And it is ticking fast. That was my experience of the fast ticking of the clock. I believe most people have that experience, and I think most people will have it before the age of 22. But I had it where I had just turned 17. And this was an advantage to me. This was an enormous advantage to me. Because I realized at the time that there was not much time. And so I realized that I would have to pick up the pace. And I began to pick up the pace. And I have attempted to continue to pick up the pace ever since. They say it's a marathon. I find that a marathon is a real long sprint. And so, because of that clicking in my mind, and it really was almost audible, but it certainly was psychological, I realized the time frame was really short. Now, you're to learn that very young, and the scriptures are filled with statements regarding the shortness of time. But to know it in terms of a principle is very different from having experienced it. And I attribute that particular event as being one of the most important events of my life, the other being the experience of Boise State. And then I became a Christian less than 8 months after that. And those three events in a period of 13 months fundamentally changed me, and I have not radically changed since that time. And that was young. And the younger it happens, the better it is for you, because you waste less time. I don't know when that will happen to you, or if it has already happened to you, but you should take that event very seriously when it happens, and it probably will happen. I can remember very clearly, when I turned 25, my grandmother said, "You will be 30 before you know it." And I knew that. I had known that at that stage for at least 8 years, and I was 50 before I knew it. Extremely fast paced beyond the age of 25. It really speeds up. Now, adults tell you this, and it does no particular good psychologically. However, it does alert you to the fact that when the event takes place, and it will take place, it will then be a reminder, a confirmation of what you've been told, and then presumably that will affect your behavior. It will affect your planning. So this presentation is about the planning phase of it. And I'm going to make basically 2 points, but I make them so often that they're really 1 point with 2 parts. And this is the distinction between the occupation and the calling. And this may have not have been presented to you before, but it is important that you understand the distinction, because you must understand the distinction to make effective use of whatever time and capital that you will possess as you grow older. The occupation is fairly simple to define. It is whatever you do that puts food on the table. That is what you exchange, usually in terms of labor or labor time, to somebody else in exchange, generally, for money, although not always, but usually. In a division of labor economy that we live in, the exchange is for money. And you can measure it fairly easily. You report your taxes accordingly. You're compensated usually by the hour, although you may get a bonus from time to time. But you can assess your input, which is in terms of hours, and compare it with your output, which is in terms of money. And making that judgment, you then, I hope, very systematically, begin to count the cost. Now, the principle of the counting of the cost is found in Luke 14, verses 28 to 32. That statement of Jesus is about counting the cost, not starting the project that you will not finish, and then be ridiculed by those around you who say he started, but he could not finish. And the biblical principle is count the cost. It's very clearly stated in that passage. Now, the counting of the cost is always an estimation. You don't know for sure in advance, but you can make reasonable estimates about what things are going to cost. And especially relating to your occupation, you must carefully consider what you're going to be called upon to do in order to be granted whatever reward is at the end of this period of time. Now, that period of time could be 30 or 40 years, depending upon the occupation you go into. Now, it will tend not to be that because of your age. because this particular economy has broken the rules which generally prevailed 50 years ago. That is, you got a job with a corporation, you kept that job for 35 or 40 years, you retired with the gold watch and the pension, and you went on to whatever years you had left. That is pretty much broken at this point. Most young men have at least four or five occupations. They change rather rapidly in the early years. We're now getting to a stage where for the first 10 years after college graduation, you're not settled occupationally. It's a new phenomenon, and it is international. Europe, it's having the same problem there, and I doubt that it's going to change because the pace of change is increasing, and it takes time to get set in terms of your occupation, to get a real clear picture in your own mind of what it is you can do and how much people are going to pay you to do that. So you will have a period, you should expect a period, of up to a decade after you receive your degree in which you are unsettled in terms of your occupational status, and you will perhaps jump from job to job or be bumped from job to job. And you must understand what is happening in Asia. That is, Indians who speak good, though accented English, with better mathematical skills than you have, and with equally good computer communications and web access rivaling yours, are now in a position to challenge your job at about 25% of the wage that you need to be comfortable. And so outsourcing is now a phenomenon. It's a very real phenomenon. It is not going to stop. And the only thing keeping the Chinese from getting in on the game is that they don't speak English so well. And when they do speak English well, or when, and it's coming, when translation software does the work for them, then you'll find the same kind of competition, except you'll be competing against, say, an extra 1.3 billion people instead of only the 1.1 or 1.2 who are now in India. This is spreading. It's not going to stop. Competition is becoming international. You're going to have to find that niche in which you have a competitive advantage, and it will not be easy to do, and the niches will close because things will be outsourced, and you will be outsourced with your career, which won't be much of a career. This is reality. You must be prepared for it. Now, there are exceptions. There are certain things that must be done locally, certain services that must be performed locally. I recommend that you look very carefully at those kinds of services where it can't be outsourced just because somebody has a good internet connection. That's the occupation side of it. You will be bounced around in all likelihood. That's really only half of it. The other half is the calling. The calling in the sense of that which God asks you to do, of a unique service. Here's how I define the calling. It is the most important thing that you can do in which you are most difficult to replace. If you can identify the most important thing that you can do in which you are most difficult to replace, then that should become the focus of your attention until such time as you either die or you are replaced. For women, it's a little easier to make that judgment because mothers are in a position of being close to irreplaceable. And for the time in which you are exercising that authority over not yet mature children, you will probably be in a position in which it's difficult to outsource that particular skill. Now, it is done. There are daycares. There are daycares that take children and educate them, and schools that do it too. But for the most part, the job is very difficult to pass on to somebody else. It is not a permanent job, however, And there is what is known as the empty nest syndrome, and it does not afflict men. The women see the children going off, and the men see the expenses going off. And it's a very different attitude. Because the men do not usually consider their role as fathers to be equal importance to the wife's role as mother. And the reason for that is the man is required to bring home the bacon, to put the food on the table. And so men tend to focus on their occupation as if it were their calling. And yet in most cases it is not. There are a few occupations which are callings, but there are not many of them. Certain people have an occupation that's a calling. Pastors usually are in a position of being paid to perform their calling. It is the most important thing they can do and which they're most difficult to replace. There are a few other occupations. Perhaps a physician who can heal people effectively who really would die. Certain kinds of brain surgeons and so forth. Well, that's probably the most important thing they can do, and yet they're very well compensated for it. But most people don't find themselves in that situation. And so it becomes a conflict, or at least a balancing act, in terms of your time and perhaps even your money, to balance your occupation with your calling. And you may find that if no one else will fund your calling, you have to fund your calling by means of your occupation, that you have to extract money out of that occupation to perform the calling. I'll give you a recent example. It's a remarkable example. It's one I only learned about a month ago. Quite astounding thing. There is an actor by the name of Sean Penn. Sean Penn has a reputation of being a bad boy. Fights, trouble, pretty good actor, I'm told. I can't ever remember seeing him in anything, but I'm told he's a good actor. Seems to be very successful. A little over a year ago, he heard about the crisis in Haiti. And he got together with some friends who were physicians. And they got some medical equipment. And they got on a plane and they flew to Haiti. And they basically went to the United States military, which does have an operation in Haiti, and said, "Here we are. Here I am. What do you want us to do?" And the military looks at this actor coming in and says, "Okay, okay, I'll tell you what. You've got this equipment. We can use the equipment. I'll give you a little assignment here. Take over this community we're setting up of refugees and orphans after the earthquake." The little community is 55,000 people. And the military said to Penn, "You run it. You raise the money. Now go away." And Penn did it. Penn now runs an operational community of refugees of 55,000 people. He raises the funds. He gets the leadership. He deals with the gangs. He deals with the army. He deals with the prostitutes. He helps set up businesses. And as he says, "I'm here for the rest of my life, and I will do the movies to fund this operation." And he's brought his children in, who are teenagers, and they're seeing the importance of what he's doing, and they have begun to commit to what he's doing. Now, Penn has a calling. He did not have a calling 24 months ago. He had an occupation 24 months ago. He now has a calling. I suspect he will stick with that calling. He will have to fund it. Now, he'll have to break and do his movies, raise his funds, and so forth. But he has a purpose now that he did not have before. I think, and he believes, this was the turning point in his life, and he says, "My children understand this now." He has a communications, a means of communications with his children that he did not have before, because they weren't going to grow up to be actors. But they can certainly grow up to be effective people helping desperate refugees in a camp of 55,000 people. This rarely happens to the very rich or the very famous, which is why I think a lot of them have a lot of guilt They don't have a calling. They have nothing like a calling. Penn doesn't brag about what he's doing. He just says, we're trying to hold the thing together, and so far, so good. And that's about the right attitude. That's how you have to look at it. And they have no idea who he is. Most of the people in the camp don't know a thing about him. Never seen a movie. Never seen him in a movie. They just know that this is the guy who keeps order and raises the funds. Now, the calling is crucial, I believe, for everyone. But it is not always the same as the occupation. And Penn understands it, and a lot of men do not understand it. And so they tend to focus their abilities, their time, their efforts on increasing their income or getting a promotion or in some way becoming players, as the phrase goes, players in their profession. And they always tell the story about the guy on the deathbed who is never known to say, I should have spent more time at the office. Or the other phrase, which I've already used in a previous talk, how much did he leave behind? All of it. Now, the scriptures are very clear in warning about this. And the scriptures exist primarily because certain men had occupations that they abandoned for the sake of their callings. Let's start with the original man who did that, Moses. Now, Moses had, I guess, an occupation, I suspect more of a calling, in Egypt, but he forfeited that by attempting to settle a dispute between an Israelite and a tyrannical local Egyptian. And he killed the Egyptian, and envy burst out rapidly within the Israelite community, and someone said, why should we listen to you, who put you over us? And he wisely got out. And so for the next 40 years, he became a shepherd, probably a pretty good shepherd. Didn't bring home the bacon, but he certainly, I guess, brought home the lamb. And he worked effectively all those years in total obscurity until the Pharaoh died, and anybody who remembered him died. And then he had the experience of the burning bush. And he did not want to go, and he kept protesting, I cannot speak, I do not have the gift of speech. And God said, you're going to go anyway, but as long as you're taking this approach, I'm going to let the speaking be done by your brother, who was still in the land. And so he went back. Now, we don't think of Moses as a shepherd, but he was a shepherd. And why was he a shepherd for 40 years? Because he had to be trained to learn how to herd humans, who were the ultimate sheep. The Israelites were sheep, that first generation of the Exodus, they were sheep. They were constantly looking back, they were constantly complaining that God had brought them into the wilderness to let them die. They were really the ultimate complainers. And they all died in the wilderness, save but two, Joshua and Caleb, who neither of whom was a complainer, and the others were. Now, they had occupations. Their occupation was wander in the wilderness for 40 years. That was their occupation. Then the children's occupation was get tired of wandering in the wilderness. That was their occupation. And they were ready to get out after 40 years of this and take some risks after 40 years of this. And so they conquered the land. Moses did not enter the land, but he wrote the manuscripts that became the Pentateuch. And so the first five books of the Bible, which establish most of what we know in terms of our ethics, our terms of law, law enforcement, those terms were written down by a man who had been for 40 years a shepherd and who presumably didn't write anything. You have the story of the prophets. For that matter, you have the story of David. David, a shepherd, getting training. You think, what in the world training did he have? Well, he fought the lion and he fought the bear. He got training in leadership and courage. And it made him a king. And he did become a king, and that did become his occupation. later, and that did become his calling later, but it wasn't how he started. Jesus was a carpenter. We don't think of him as a carpenter, but that was his occupation for a time. It was not his calling. We know nothing of his calling during that period. We do know that he abandoned that calling and called a group of fishermen to abandon their occupation or vocation to be fishers of men. That whole language of fishers of men, what is that? It's the language of the calling. It's the most important thing that they could do, in which they would have been most difficult to replace. Then you have the case of Paul, actually Saul, who was a scholar by trade. He had been trained by Gamaliel. He was a persecutor by occupation, acting on behalf of the Jewish leaders, searching out Christians to persecute, arrest, perhaps execute, held the cloak of Stephen at that execution. So he would have been regarded by the church at the time as being a paid executioner, or at least a collaborator, and a dangerous man. And he was so regarded. And it took several years to convince the people in Jerusalem that he wasn't that. But what was he? Well, we're told what he was. It's in Acts 18:3. He was a tent maker. He made his money sewing tents and selling them for a living. That was his occupation. Now, he had that occupation for a specific reason, and he said so in his letter to the Corinthians. Second letter, he said, I don't take money from you. I support myself. He said, I could take money, but I don't take money. That was how he maintained his independence. He was beholden to nobody except those people who wanted to buy a tent. He was beholden to them, and so he exercised his calling as a preacher and as a writer of the crucial letters of the New Testament, but he maintained that occupation in a very mundane way of simply sewing together tents and marketing them. He was a businessman on the side. And he maintained his independence. And he needed his independence because he had a lot of opposition. But because he had financial independence from those he was leading and giving instruction to, he was able to give far better instruction. He was not afraid of them. They couldn't cut him off. That is the advantage of the man who finds an occupation which is sufficiently profitable to be able to put that food on the table on a regular basis, but at the same time, to take a portion of that money and set that aside for other kinds of service. Could be travel, could be developing these days an internet site of some kind, developing skills of writing or speaking, leading some kind of group in the church. There are many areas of service that are available to people. Now, I'm going to point out something that you may not have heard of, and you may not hear of it again, but it will control your life. And so you might as well be aware of it. And it's the Pareto Law. And people don't understand the Pareto Law, even the ones who quote it. Vilfredo Pareto was a sociologist slash economist of the late 19th century. He began to study income distribution of European countries. And he found a rather remarkable fact. 20% of the population had 80% of the wealth in every country. It was an extraordinary finding. It didn't make sense. And since that was published in 1897, these studies keep being made. And time and again, 20% of the population have 80% of the wealth. And it doesn't matter who's in charge, and it doesn't matter what political system is in charge, and it doesn't matter what the rhetoric is, and it doesn't matter who got elected. It matters for the individuals, perhaps, because the faces change, but the income distribution doesn't. Then we find that it applies across the board in everything else, almost everything else. 20% of the police on a police force make 80% of the arrests. 20% of the people on your mailing list, if you have a mailing list, provide 80% of the income. 20% of the people in your congregation provide 80% of the congregation's income. Over and over, across the board, this thing operates. We don't know why. We don't know why, and so because we don't know why, and because the economists don't know why, they do exactly what every intelligent economist does. He doesn't talk about the Pareto Law. But it exists. And what you find is in all leadership capacity, in every area of service that you want to go into, if the group is large enough, several hundred people, the Pareto Law is going to manifest itself. 20% of the people will have 80% of the influence or the wealth. By the way, it keeps going all the way up. 4% of the people will probably control close to half. Probably 1% of the people will control half. We don't know why. But it applies so consistently that if you ignore it, you're making a horrendous mistake. Now, what I would recommend is this. In both your calling and your occupation, you attempt to get at least in the top 20% of the performances. In whatever occupation you get into, you try your very best to get into that top 20%. Now, if you get to the top 4%, that is 20% of 20%, you have really got to be good. I think it's more than just good. You have got to be phenomenal, and you've got to have almost the intervention of God to put you in that position. You can't really plan to get in that top 4%. And with respect to the top 1%, don't even think about it. Now, we all know certain numbers of people, or you will know certain numbers of people as in your life who will get to that top 1%. Lenny Ross is in the top 1%, maybe even the next group up. You find these people. And by the way, as you get better, let me warn you, as you get better and better and better, you move up. And you know what happens? You get surrounded by people who are just as good as you, and then you're looking at the top 20% of that group. And you think, man, how do I get up to the top? And it doesn't matter how many times you get promoted, you'll find those guys at the top. We know for a fact, or at least a pretty statistical fact, that the richest 3,000 people in the world own or control as much wealth as probably half the world's population at the bottom. They may not own it directly, but they control it. They have influence directing it. Top 6,000 people in the world, they know each other, they understand each other, they share each other's basic views. 30% of them have gone to the same 25 or 30 universities, same perspective, same collegiate indoctrination system. There's a book called Superclass that talks about it. And you can find it on the web. The guy's name is Rothkopf. You want to have some fun, just spend an hour on the web with maybe his speech at Stanford. Rothkopf, Rothkopf, talks about the top 6,000 people and the influence. We all know where they went. In fact, he was at Stanford, and he looks out at the audience and he says, yes, 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 here. Stanford, Princeton, Harvard, Yale, Chicago, Wharton, finance, in other words, Pennsylvania, Berkeley, Oxford, Cambridge, Paris. We know the schools. It never changes. It doesn't change year to year, decade to decade. It's the same schools that have run the show for at least 100 years. And at least 25 to 30% of the 6,000 people who make the decisions of where all that capital goes and what's to be done with it, they all went to these same schools. The same humanist worldview is where they got their training. And we are not represented at the top. We may have a few guys in it. I don't know anybody up there. There may be somebody. I don't know anybody. We have a hierarchical system
In other words, point two, the hierarchical system which is shaped by the universities of this world. A handful of these universities. The 20% of the 20% of the 20% of the universities are shaping the minds of the 20% of the 20% of the 20% of the deal doers of the world. And they don't share our view of the covenant. So we are on the outside and they are on the inside. They are in the inner ring. We are not in the inner ring. You are not going to get in the inner ring. I hope you will not even be invited into the inner ring. But you better believe that it exists. Now, what's our job? In whatever group you're in whatever area of responsibility you have, strive to get to the top 20%. Because that's where the influence is. That's where the responsibility is concentrated. And if you have the talent and you walk away from that opportunity, you're walking away from your calling. Now, I'm not convinced that everybody can do this in an occupation. You may be in some particular occupation where getting in the top 20% is just extremely difficult. Surgery, perhaps, or some form of advanced engineering. You can't claw your way into the top 20%, but in your calling, you can. Because that's what the calling is about. You want to be in the person who is in a position of such great responsibility that it's very difficult to replace that person. Why? Because he's maybe in at least in the top 20% and maybe in the top 20% of the 20%, that top 4%. Then you're tough to replace. Now, you can find an area of service in your life somewhere by the time you're 35 years old in which you can say with pretty good authority, I'm in the top 20% here. Now, maybe you can't do it statistically in terms of counting heads, but you can pretty well tell. You go to the conferences, you know who's speaking. Maybe you got a workshop. Now, that doesn't mean you're a headline speaker, but you got a workshop. You're good enough to get that workshop where you're making life easier for somebody else. You're bringing something to the table in which, because you showed up, somebody has a better shot at being a good servant in his area. So you got a workshop. And maybe you're 30 and you've got a workshop. Oh, what's your job then? Show up to the workshops, present good information, and maybe in the next year they'll make you the 8 a.m. speaker to come and talk. That's good too. And bit by bit, as you perform in whatever this area is, you will be recognized as somebody who is competent, who is entertaining, and who shows up. And Woody Allen became famous for his statement that 80% of success in life is just showing up. And there's a great deal of truth to that. Just show up. Because a lot of people don't show up. Show up on time. A lot of people don't show up on time. Now, I'm going to give you a rule of three. If you do these three things, you will be successful. You will get to the top 20%. Three simple principles, easily memorized, and even more easily ignored. Principle number one, do what you say you will do. Principle number two, do it at the price agreed on. And principle number three, do it on time. Those are the three principles. Do what you say you're going to do. Do it at the price agreed on. Do it on time. Now, what you really want to do is do what you say you're going to do and a little more. Do it at the price agreed on and offer an extra benefit or even a discount and get it finished one day early, just in case. Now, that's how you better write your term papers. Do not write your term paper on the assumption you're going to hand in the term paper on the last day. Do not do that. Schedule it so that you have the term paper finished at least the day before.
And the reason for that is because you're going to reread it the day before and you're going to say, I didn't think I said anything like that, and you're going to have an all-nighter preparing it for the day that it's due. That's reality. You learn that in college, that's a pretty good lesson. It may not be worth $250,000, but it's a good lesson. Now, if people would do that, if people would consistently do those three things, they could gather sufficient trust of the people they work with so that the people would say, this person is reliable, we can trust that person to hold up his end of the deal so that if there is a crisis, it doesn't fall apart because he didn't show up. And you would be astounded at how few people on a consistent basis can do those three things. What do I think the percentage is? I think it's about 20%. And if you learn early to do those three things, then you have got the basics of, I believe, a successful occupation, but I also believe you would have the basics of a successful calling, an area of service which may not be paid for directly, may not be paid for in money, but will be paid for on that day of reckoning, that final day of reckoning in which people's lives are assessed in terms of what they achieved. And there is that final day. And we'll find time and again that many people on that day that we didn't think were all that outstanding will prove to be remarkable because they did it quietly. And Jesus said that too, especially with respect to giving. Remember the famous line about, do not let the right hand know what the left hand does, or vice versa, with respect to giving away of money. You don't know what people have done. People can come out of nowhere and be remarkably successful. Sean Penn came out of nowhere. Unpredictable individual came out of nowhere to achieve something great. There are open statements by senior military commanders down there saying, we don't like his politics, but he is doing a tremendous job down here. Now, Christians should be the ones doing this. Let me give you an example. 10 years ago, actually a little longer, about 11 years ago, I did regular evangelism work at a Texas state prison. It was a tough prison. It was a level 5 prison. That meant it had multiple guard towers, 24 hours a day of sharpshooters, which meant you didn't get out of that prison, at least not alive. It was a tough prison. There's a group of them in this huge area in central Texas, which is tens of thousands of acres, just to have 5 prisons. Nobody gets out. They don't have escapees. They're tough guys. In that prison, there is the division of labor. That prison supplies the meat for other prisons, pork mainly. So they grow the corn, they feed the pigs, they slaughter the pigs, and then, however the distribution system works within the prison, they supply pork for other prisons in the system. That's one of its two specialties. It had a second specialty, and that specialty was, it was the hospice for the whole Texas state prison system. And when a guy got an incurable disease and they knew he had 6 months left, something like that, they would move him out of the prison he was in and they would send him to the prison where I did the ministry. And so there was a specific wing in that prison of dying men. And they were treated well. They had their own room. They probably had a television, which the other prisoners didn't have anything like that, because they weren't going to be there very long. And they knew they were not going to be there very long. And most of them had no friends, and they had no relatives. They were dying alone in this Texas prison. That was the extent of their life, and they knew the clock was ticking. But the interesting thing about that was this. Nobody in that prison, and it was a tough prison, nobody wanted to work in the hospice.
except the Christians. That was an easy job. There was no sweat. There was not any kind of, there was no violence. You were separated from the really bad guys in the prison for at least 8 hours a day. You got away from them because nobody's going to kill you in the hospice. And they couldn't recruit guys to do it. There were guys out there in the middle of Texas, July, summer, working in that garden, that big garden area to grow the corn to feed the pigs, with the guards on horseback with the rifles, and those guys preferred to sweat in the Texas sun, where any of them, if he put in an application, could have gone to the hospice. They didn't want to be around dead people and dying people. They didn't want to see the face of death because they knew what they were and they knew what they had done. And you didn't have a tough time convincing those guys that there is judgment. And so the Christians were almost universally the guys who served in the hospice. They were willing to deal with death. They could bring the gospel to these guys and so forth. They had a calling. They had an occupation, too. Didn't get much money for it. They got something for it. But those guys had a calling. But they didn't have a calling outside in what they called the free world. They had no calling in the free world. They got into prison, and they found their calling. It was the most important thing they could do, in which they were most difficult to replace. What I'm telling you is this. You got to work really hard, especially the males, to find out what your calling is. And it is probably not going to be your occupation. My occupation is writing 4 articles a day and answering 2 or 3 dozen questions. And I do that about, depending on a good day versus a bad day, somewhere between 8 hours a day and 12 hours, depending on whether I got an article to write. But the rest of the time is my calling, which is writing an economic commentary on the Bible, which I began in 1973 and have scheduled to end. I've got less than 12 months and I've just about made it. And then I've got to write my final books on Christian economics, but I had to do the first, from 1973 to 2011, I had to do that to do the exegetical work so I could do the final volumes. That was the homework assignment. That's what it was. 10 hours a week, 50 weeks a year, 1977, and then to the present, and then before that, 1 article a month, in which I wasn't doing it fast enough. This is what you have to do. I funded it. Nobody pays me for it. For one stage, I had to raise $2 million of donations to get the books published. Never took any money for the books. Same reason Paul didn't. You can't pin them on my donkey that I did it for the money, because I didn't do it for the money. That's my calling. And you know what's happened? I always had money coming in the door. Never had a time when I didn't have plenty of money coming through the door. I don't have to worry about money. I worry about time. Clock's ticking. I've known that since 17. The clock is ticking. But I don't have to worry about money. Money always shows up. Money is not your problem. Time is your problem. Money is not your problem. Finding your calling is your problem. If you find your calling and work to get into that top 20%, the money will come. Don't worry about the money. Worry about your time. The clock is ticking. You don't have a lot of time. The final statement is this. Many years ago, Ben Franklin wrote a famous thing called Poor Richard's Almanac. And he made this statement. He said, a child believes that 20 pounds in 20 years can never be spent. But they can, and they go very fast. Look for your calling. Don't worry about your job. Find the calling, and the job will take care of itself. If you trust God on that, then you will find yourself in 20 years or 30 years in that top 20%. And that's where you belong. That's where you belong, not in the bottom 80. I wish you the best.